Therapy Insiders is brought to you by Verve, makers of the Arc, a revolutionary neck pain relief and postural support device. Available now at www.goarcnow.com and by Edge Mobility System. Give your mobility the edge. Available at www.edgemobsys.com.
Hello, welcome back to Therapy Insiders. I'm Dr. Gene Schirakerbrod, here with Dr. Joe Palmer, back from his Vegas trip, and Dr. Erson Religioso. See, I've been practicing. I got it down this time. And today, we want to talk about running. I know we already had a running episode way back when, but new perspectives, a current different outlook on some exercises and some joint assessments, and we'll see what we come up with. So let me start with Dr. Joe here, back from his Vegas trip.
Hey, Gene. Glad to be back.
Quote-unquote conference. You kind of live running, don't you,
Joe? I live it vicariously.
Still live it. It's part of your daily life, part of your fiber, so to speak. Whether you see it in the clinic, and Joe will tell you why it's part of his daily life. When somebody tells you that they're a runner and they come in with pain, regardless of where it is, do you have a sort of assessment or a routine that you know you need to go through because they're a runner?
Well, I think that the important thing is to then go through a whole different line of questioning. I feel like you need to take a much more detailed subjective and get a lot more background information before you even start to test and address the patient. So first, you know, runners, they have very set goals, and you want to get an impression of what their training habits are prior to coming to see you, and what their goals are, where they're trying to go. I think any changes that they've made on or about the time of their symptom onset can really point you in the right direction, and you haven't even done any tests yet. So I think that that's where I always start. I always go through a much more detailed form of questioning, and I don't assume anything when I'm dealing with a runner that's training for a race,
which is good, because that helps mitigate bias, right? When you start assuming things, you instantly bias yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's simple things like changing their shoes, or changing, or maybe they always run the same route, the same course. I mean, there are little things that that can affect when you're training for something so hard and for so long. You're at high risk for overuse type injuries anyway. There are subtle changes that go on that it's not necessarily that the runner is trying to hide them from you, or they don't know unless you bring it up as, hey, this is important. You need to tell me everything about what you're doing.
That's a good point. A thorough subjective. How about you, Dr. E? How do you deal with your runners?
Well, I love treating runners, and I basically started running again 3 years ago after being a pretty avid runner. I mean, I never ran more than 5 or 10 Ks. I'm not a crazy half marathon or marathon person, but I understand the mentality, because I'm that way with fitness in general, just not running. But 2-3 years ago, I fell upon Irene Davis's work. Are you guys familiar with her?
I'm not, but did you actually fall on it, or just the
figure? Yes, yes, I actually fell on top of a pile of research papers and a YouTube video. And she's a PT researcher who also quit running for, I don't even know how long, quite a while. And you know, she's into biomechanics. And she was one of the runners who, along with the barefoot professor Dan Lieberman, they started popularizing, you know, barefoot running and forefoot running, midfoot running. So when I saw her research and I saw the force graphs and basically how, you know, if you land on the forefoot, that takes a lot of pressure off of the knees, because my problem was knee pain. And when I transitioned then from a rear foot strike to a midfoot strike, even though I was running a lot slower, I was able to get rid of my knee pain. So I actually treated a lot of my patients based on that for at least a year and a half. And then, you know, someone basically argued with me on Twitter that you can't just eliminate force, that the force has to come somewhere. And even though people who run with a midfoot strike maybe have less knee pain, they have more Achilles issues or calf issues. And that just kind of got me thinking. And I tried to do the same thing with my wife. I tried to transition her into, you know, more of like a big heeled type cushiony shoe to a minimalist shoe. And my plan was to go all the way down to, you know, either Vibrams or something like that, but not full barefoot. And it just absolutely would not work on her, and she just needed inserts. And I just thought, you know, all these things started have me question things, and it didn't work. Like, for as many people as changing their stride and coaching them on that, plus all the additional manual therapy and for symmetry and things like that, it was working as much as it wasn't working. So when I really started to critically look at the research, I saw that really the only thing that is predictive, and this is why I like Craig Payne, the Running Research Junkie. It's a great website. I believe he's a podiatrist. But, you know, he breaks down all the popular running myths just according to the research. And really what he says is that with any kind of running injury or athletic injury or injury in general, but let's just stick to running, is that your training overexceeds your capacity. That's all it is. And for whatever reason, you know, capacity might be a variance in ability to load, or it could be just asymmetry in movement or motor control, but in the end, it's just that. And, you know, plenty of people have heel strike or midfoot strike or toe strike or whatever, and it's not necessarily predictive of one's not better than the other. It's just, there's too many variables in terms of individuality.
The APTA just came out with a patient perspective on that, and they had it as the risk increased if your mileage increased more than 30% in a given week's time. I think the common increase is a 10%. At least that's what I try to use when I'm trying to coach my runners for return to running. But they found that it was most predictive of injury if they increased greater than a 30% in mileage in a week's time.
That's a lot.
It's a lot. You've never had a patient that increased more than 30%?
Yes, I was actually that patient. And my knee was hurting for quite a while. Yeah, it wasn't a great idea.
Yeah, it usually isn't. I mean, that's why patients exist in the first place. Thank you, Dr. E, for making that case very clear for us.
You know, Dr. E, though, I hear what you're saying. I follow about not being able to get rid of you're not being able to eliminate any of the forces. But if you do have the patient, like you're saying, that their trouble is knee pain, you've not found it useful to try to get them into the midfoot strike, or they struggle to totally adapt? Because I find, you know, saying that you want to try to convert a patient into running how they're not naturally, you know, made to run, because people, you know, they start running and they develop these motor patterns, and I feel like it's very hard to change them at times.
Well, the one thing that I've really been basing a lot of my eclectic approach and just neurologic explanations on is that the CNS just needs variability, and it's just one of those things that obviously we're there to promote change and throw a wrench whatever is going on. So in general, yeah, based on what the force plates show and where the forces end up going, whether you're a heel striker, a 4-foot striker, or, you know, toe striker, which is rare, but, you know, maybe in sprinting. But if someone has knee pain, potentially they would need to lean forward a little bit and do more of a midfoot strike, because the forces would definitely be off of their knee and more on the Achilles and the posterior chain rather than anterior. So
right, you're decreasing that lever arm.
Yeah, that might be the change they need. But what I first try to do is I analyze them in slow motion from the front, the back, the side, the top, and the bottom. And, you know, I look at it, and I see that for the majority of the time, there is some sort of asymmetry in the arm swing, because the arms drive the legs. And typically, many times, as a pattern, not always, but the lower limb that has the problem is overstriding. So even before I try to change, I think it's easier to change an overstride than it is to change an actual landing pattern.
I agree with that. I think another point to be made is I think it's dependent where the pain in the knee is. And I don't think each symptom of pain is the same, at least what I find in runners, that if they're complaining of a little bit of medial knee pain versus right at middle knee pain or the joint line, it depends what the cause is, lateral to medial. And that's made a big difference in the way I look at runners, because they'll come in and tell me they have pain in certain areas, and it doesn't really mean much. And changing, I used to change their landing pattern a lot. And I like, you know, I went through heel strike, I went through liking midfoot. I never really liked 4-foot running for a long distance. But what I found was if you look at the joints and if you look at their overall mechanics, I think they really go hand in hand in figuring out where their restriction could be coming from causing the pain. So let's say if they have medial knee pain, I mean, there's a handful of things medial knee pain could be, right?
Yes.
I mean, it could be a pretty mechanical issue, and a meniscus injury would be pretty common, right? Runner putting a lot of mileage, putting a lot of stress on the meniscus, especially if they have tibial torsion and torquing even more, and putting kind of crunching down on that medial meniscus. You can have referral pain from the adductors if they have increased genu valgum during their initial stance, when they heel with either heel strike or midfoot. If their knee collapses a little bit, puts a little bit of stress, a little stretch on that adductor, it can be pretty painful for them. So it's figuring out what the patient's actually trying to tell you before trying to make big drastic changes. But to me, there's one joint that I always look at for runners regardless, and I don't know if you guys are the same or different. It's always important for me to look at the great toe, the first ray in a runner, because I need to see how well they're pushing off at in terminal stance, because to me that's a kind of a linchpin and the rest of the mechanic that I want to look at in running. What about you guys? Do you look at the toes? Is there a joint that you know, hey, I need to look at this no matter what?
I'm definitely looking at the toe, but I think that if you're going to go from the bottom up, you also come from the top down, and I find that a lot of runners have restricted hips as well, tight hip flexors, and that can lead to a decrease in their stride length and extension. But you know, you start from the pelvis, go down, or start from the toe and go up. I think that's personal preference. As long as you do them both, you're going to do your patient service.
That's true. And again, with the knee pain, I think I mentioned greater trochanter. And I see that a lot is people complaining of IT band issues, even though it's just, you know, referral pain from that area, whether it's the IT band being on increased tautness from the tensor fascia lata facilitation could be causing a little bit of IT band tautness as well, so, and having that lateral knee pain. So, and with the hip flexors, Joe, you mentioned, I find that patients that have TL junction issues, and going back to Erson's mentioning of limitation during arm swing, and that could be not just arm swing, but the actual trunk having restriction in rotation, because one of the biggest pivot points in the trunk, the TL junction, has a restriction, and the nerves that work, obviously the psoas and the hip flexors, come from right at that TL junction area. So if I find a arm swing asymmetry, that's one of the first things that I'm going to look at, as well as the TL junction.
Right. I definitely agree with all that. And because I'm doing an SFMA on every patient, especially my very active patients, I typically start from the head and then go down. But for any kind of unilateral lower quarter issue, I will especially pay attention to, say, if it was a left leg, anywhere in the left leg, that typically they will have some sort of asymmetry in the right arm. Maybe it would be slightly abducted. They typically will have a loss of medial rotation and extension. So in the SFMA, that pattern would be, you know, broken up into arm extension plus internal rotation plus thoracic rotation that way. Because I do find that, you know, there's a unilateral thoracic rotation issue. And then going on to the opposite, like the contralateral, that would be on the contralateral arm, because that's what drives that leg. So it'd be the right arm that would be driving that involved left leg. And potentially, again, as a pattern, they'd probably have some sort of hip issue, usually a lack of extension, which is then causing an overstride moment, which then increases the ground reaction force and potentially causes that whole chain to break down somewhere.
Yeah, and that's one of the I think most fun things to look at with runners, is that whole one piece can just unravel the whole chain, and you really have to have a keen eye and an understanding of the mechanics of movement when working with runners. And that's one of the most fun things, I think. So I know me personally, again, I'm going to look at TL junction, I'm going to look at the lumbar spine, I'm going to look at hip joint motion, I'll look at subtalar joint, and always the first ray. You know, I'd like runners to have anywhere from 60 to 90 degrees of first toe extension, preferably towards the 75 to 90. I know 60 is kind of a minimum. What about you guys? I know research shows that you kind of need 60 to function. But do you really, is it me over focusing on the first ray?
Or no,
do you
it's
guys
not
look at it as well? I feel like I'm bringing the first toe here, and nobody's backing me up here.
You do have a little bit of a foot thing.
Two toes up, yes.
Who's got a toe in this fight? Come on now.
Right. I agree with you. I agree. Definitely. And I don't like the 60 degrees either.
It's important, Gene. Just take a look at their toe and, you know, diagnose.
All I need is one toe and I'm done. That's all I need.
That's it. Great toe. It's a salt. It's just like a chicken or the egg thing again.
It's the egg.
Came first.
The chicken came from the egg. The egg has to come first. It's simple. It's just deductive reasoning.
Yes. But yeah, I absolutely look at the great toe in the first ray. And I find that a lot of ankle dorsiflexion issues and overpronation potential issues with that, you know, too many toes sign that you see posteriorly, I don't know what came first. Again, was it a lack of great toe extension, or was it that they started everting from a lack of dorsiflexion, which then they weren't pushing off? I mean, but either way, you have to address both of those things. And, you know, too many therapists just only work on ankle dorsiflexion, and they restore it without the ability to push off. So yeah, I absolutely agree that is a linchpin in lower quarter function. But I would just say it's equally important with ankle dorsiflexion in a neutral position, which would cause the ability to have that rigid lever from forefoot supination, as well as tibial internal rotation and hip extension. All those things are things I want to restore.
Absolutely. I mean, those are pretty important for a good running pattern. So once, let's say, everything is restored, we get all those joints working, and any of our listeners want to see any of the techniques that we use for our joints, let us know. Let Dr. E know at themanualtherapist.com. I'm sure he'll post something about this podcast. Then we can put something together for you guys for our running techniques. But let's say we're moving on, right? We got the joints where we want them to be. How about some muscle groups, some movement patterns, some exercises that you have that are some of your favorites for runners that you kind of run them through to make sure that they can do? No pun intended. Ah, hell, pun intended. I'll take it.
Yes. I like single limb stance drills, obviously. I mean, single limb squat because basically running is thousands and thousands of aggressive single limb squats, you know, dynamic squats, hops they need to be able to do. You know, because if they can't do a single limb squat slowly without a tremendous amount of valgus, knee valgus, then they're not going to be able to run doing that either. So, excuse me. That would be like one of the definite things I start with.
I like the step down test. I use the step down test a lot when I'm looking at do they have the balance eccentric control from the quadriceps as well as hip stability to return to running. That's one of my tests that I like to use. I like to train the posterior chain a lot, either bridges, single leg bridges, or elevated bridges on a ball. Really work the whole posterior chain.
The step down test. Can you describe that?
Sure. You want to set somebody up on a 8-inch step, and their object is to go and tap their heel forward down on the step and then come back up, and you're comparing side to side, looking for knee valgus and whether they're able to maintain stability throughout the whole motion.
I see. That I like that one a lot too. That's one of my favorites. One that I do that I have my runners do, and I actually have them do this before they start running as a warm up. Because God forbid they stretch, then I have to shake them, and that's a whole different conversation. But I put them in front of a wall or a tree or anything they can get their feet in front of and flush against it and make them do a squat without their knees touching the wall, and they go down, and probably 8 out of 10 will have a hitch. So as they're going down, they're going to want to keel back, meaning... And it's more than just working the quads. It actually becomes a very good hip mobilization exercise. When the tibia and the femur can't slide forward, all they can do is slide back into the hip joint. And it works really well. After a couple weeks of runners doing that, doing 20 or 30 couple sets before running, and even after running as a cool down, you see pretty good hip motion from them. After that, so that's one of my favorites.
I also like the go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was going to ask you about some strengthening exercises that you guys do.
Well, in terms of strengthening, again, because this is like an FMS and SFMA thing, a lot of people will have, you know, it's like the epidemic of tight hamstrings, and everyone always wants to stretch their tight hamstring. But for me, it's more about facilitating the hip flexors and inhibiting the hip extensors, because very few people have a tight hamstring. It's more a tone issue. So you'll check them and they can't touch their toes, and actively they maybe only get to 35 or 45 degrees of straight leg raise with ankle dorsiflexion, but passively they can get to maybe 70 or 80 or even 90 with no issue. So that proves to them it's absolutely not a length issue. So I like to do the core activated straight leg raise, where you kind of just brace the TA and I have both of the arms kind of facing upward toward the ceiling. If they're lying on their back, one hand kind of pushes into the other hand, so when you take a deep breath in, you push up with one hand, you push down the other, so they don't go anywhere, and it kind of helps just brace the core a bit better. And then typically when they do the active straight leg raise with the TA or the core activation and a good exhalation to get the diaphragm and the pelvic floor working as well, their leg goes right up. So they learn how to inhibit their hamstring actively, or at least appropriately, opposed to having too much tone when the hip is flexing.
Yeah, that sounds like a pretty tough one there.
Works really well, actually. It's one of those things that just automagically lengthens the hamstrings. You immediately grow new sarcomeres, since everyone wants to stretch so much.
So what's the carryover like with that? I mean, what's your dosage there? I mean, you do it a couple times and they get up and they're more flexible in functional positions?
Yeah, well, that's like the regression to the toe touch, because, you know, you maybe do that, maybe they're only limited in toe touch on one side, because again, part of the SFMA, you do like a toe touch and then you put one foot forward and then you try to touch like the back foot and you put the other foot forward and try to touch the back foot to kind of rule out one chain versus the other posteriorly. And then typically you would just exercise, you would just move, you know, the one in active straight leg raise and supine, and you kind of work toward more functional positions and weight bearing. But the carryover is pretty well. Just like any other movement pattern, it does need to be trained in different positions to have carryover from weight-bearing to non-weight-bearing. But many times people just can't do, because weight-bearing is typically a more threatening position, so you need to kind of reduce the threat and regress it to progress. So that's why I do it in supine first, and then do it in weight-bearing second.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good exercise. Another one I like is an isometric one, but with a little bit of a twist. Again, finding a wall or stationary object, having a person lean their leg, one leg, slightly flexed at the hip, off the ground, and push it into the wall as the person kind of sits back into a little squat position, and then they try to move the wall with their leg against, that's like pressing into the wall. Have you ever done that one? Where you're creating an isometric abduction, external rotation of the hip.
I like that one a lot.
So what I've started doing was on the contralateral knee, the one that's weight-bearing, is, and actually I've been using Dr. E's edge mobility bands on this, is wrapping the edge mobility band against the other leg and creating external rotation with slight extension on there. So they have two forces going at the same time, and that is brutal. For 30 seconds.
Yeah, we talked about it earlier, basically before the podcast. So I have like limited ability to picture things only when I only hear audio. So I'm just like I'm looking at these 2D stick figures in my brain, and I can't make them triplanar.
I was wondering what the steam was coming out of my computer. Must be thinking. Right.
Yes, it's me being a visual learner and not an auditory learner.
Yeah, that description left a little to be desired as well. But
actually, probably all of ours are. We will try to make pictures or videos of any of the things you guys request.
We will draw pretty pictures.
Because obviously, we all know what we're talking about, but no one else probably knows what we're talking about.
So all of this is a ploy to get more people commenting and engaged in the podcast. So get engaged. Tell us what you want to know, what you want to see, and we'll supply it through our various social media avenues.
Yes, we had a comment that we were being too comprehensive, so there were no questions. So we thought we would be more vague.
Exactly.
The other, you know, another one for hip stability as well as core gene that goes along with the one that I think you just described is. A side plank with the superior leg doing a abduction. So you do a side plank with a variation of top leg abduction, and as soon as you lift that top leg, the ground leg is taking all of the force. So
yeah, that's a great one. I do a similar one. I just do it as a clamshell. With side plank and a clamshell, and that works pretty good. Or clamshell with a band around the knees, or clamshell even with manual resistance from your hands, are all pretty good.
Yeah, I love that side plank and that star that you described, Joe. Actually, some people in Pilates, they even do it with the arm, also the upward arm abducting, and that's pretty brutal from a stability standpoint. But I've even modified the side plank a bit more, which I call like a change assessment, almost based on like an anatomy trains type assessment, where I don't, because typically you cue someone to side plank, they kind of use their QL and their hip abductors, but now I'm just trying to cue people to mainly focus on their hip abductors, and then I'll do a closed chain hip adductor. So say, and I'll find that usually someone with a unilateral problem will say, like if it's a right knee problem and they're doing a right side plank, that will be difficult because they won't be able to push their trunk up by abducting their right leg into the ground. But then if you, say, put their left leg up on you know, like a step and you put a cushion underneath their ankle and then have them adduct closed chain, no one ever adducts closed chain. And that's pretty brutal to lift your body up off of that. And I find that people who have abduction weakness, say, on the right, will have closed chain adduction on the left.
That's interesting.
Yeah,
try it with unilateral presentations, and even try it on yourselves, because you know most of us have unilateral issues, and I know that it is the same for me. Like I'm always working on my right hip abductors, but my left hip adductors are pretty much equally as weak. And in a closed chain, it is brutal. and you usually need some sort, you know, you need to make the lever arm shorter, or you need some sort of assistance. But yeah, it's an awesome exercise. That's what I do when someone is in kind of like the pain-free motor patterns are restored, and I'm just kind of working on, you know, strength and stability and capacity.
I feel like the adductors are in general completely underlooked as a pain generator and referral for a lot of dysfunction. I find that when I see some runners that have kind of been around the block with some places, and I poke around their adductors, I mean, they almost jump off the table, and a lot of quads are actually adductor strains. And it's definitely an important muscle group to look at as a whole for runners or for anybody that does any kind of dynamic activity. So definitely don't forget not only to work the adductors, but to assess them and palpate around and see what you find in there.
Yeah, I mean, I just took dry needling just this summer, and you know, it's a review for someone like me who moved away from anatomy so much. But yeah, you look at like the adductor magnus. I mean, they were calling it a ham hock, and it's true. That thing is like,
it's huge.
It's like an extra hamstring.
It's huge. Yeah.
And you don't think of your adductors as that big. So yeah, unless you're a pelvic floor therapist, you probably by and large have ignored them.
Well, also the adductors are one of the few muscle groups that actually refer proximally as well. And I learned this in my dry needling course that I took with Jan Dahmerholt and my pain seminars, was that adductors can cause pain into the pelvis, where usually referral pain goes proximal to distal. So it's very, very important muscles to look at.
Yeah.
So we threw out a few exercises at you guys, some joint assessments to look at, some visual images to try to paint. Like I said, anything you guys want to see, we have several ways to get it to you via Dr. E's, the Manual Therapist blog. Our website, therapyinsiders.com. We've been posting on Reddit, obviously on Twitter, on Dr. E's Facebook. He posts once the podcast is out. So have a listen. Let us know what you want to see. Comment, and we'll try to get everything together that you want to know. Anything else? Any final comments, closing thoughts on running?
I got to give a shout out to my wife, the runner. Casey, I hope you like the episode, because I treat a lot of runners, because I treat a lot of her friends.
And then
your wife listens to the podcast. My wife doesn't even like read my social media.
Every podcast.
Well, that's because she actually cares.
Right.
She's it all comes back full circle now. When I mentioned in the beginning about Joe's ingrained life in running, it's because Casey's such an avid and very good runner that that Joe is always around running. And I don't know if we should share this publicly like this, Joe. Running is the reason you almost lost a finger.
Oh yeah, I did one marathon, and it was a traumatizing experience for me. But you know, I got a wife out of it. So what are you gonna do?
Nice.
It's a good deal all around.
That's a good deal. It probably would even been worth, a wife is almost worth the finger too.
And the finger stayed on.
Oh, that's even better.
Although I did have to effleurage his legs for I feel like a whole week.
It's good practice for you.
Were you guys in PT school or something? What were you doing effleurage for?
Yeah, we were in PT school.
Yeah. All
right. That's the only time you ever do effleurage. Rather forget that.
Yeah.
We got to know it all.
The last time I heard that word.
All right. So thanks for listening to Therapy Insiders podcast, our running part deux episode. If you guys want to know anything, leave us a comment. We're available via various social media channels.
Various.
Dr. East. Numerous. TheManualTherapist.com. What else you got? Remind me.
EdgeMobilitySystem.com, PhysioAnswers.com, StopThoughtViruses.com. All those have Facebook pages too, and I have two Twitter accounts, a Pinterest, and a YouTube channel. And a lot of my videos are on YouTube.com, or you know, YouTube.com/ReligiosoPT. But I also have a paid channel for $4.99 a month that has literally every single manual technique that I've ever taught, some lectures, and hours and hours and hours of cases from my courses, because every time I teach a course, I'll probably do about two or three live cases. because we're all dysfunctional.
There you go. We are definitely all dysfunctional, some more than others. So on that note, thanks for listening. Let us know if there's anything else you guys want to hear about. We'll get it to you in a week or so. So for Dr. Joe Palmer and Dr. E, Dr. Gene Sharakabrad, thanks for listening.
Have a good week.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening, Casey. Yeah. So, Joe, how do you commonly treat neck pain?
Well, that's very interesting. Yes. It's Joe's views on literal mechanical neck pain. He's actually treating other cyborgs. And that's...